I've got the advantage. I can see people still trickling in from the council chamber, so just... Great. Right, well, I'm going to make a start. Welcome to this afternoon's event. Many of you know me, some of you don't, so I'll tell you who I am. I'm Fiona Morrison, and I'm president of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, and the big hint is I've got this sort of jewellery thing around my, around my neck. Big data, it's a really sexy term, and... I'm not allowed to use it this afternoon. So when I was given some notes so that Michael knew what I was going to say, they then had to sort of have global substitute of other terms, and I'm going to explain that in a minute. And what that is trivialising is the fact that this is an incredibly important subject. And so it's really, really important that we have a working party looking at it. And it's not called the Big Data Working Party. It is called, and this isn't a very sexy term, the Modelling Analytics and Insights from Data Working Party. Sorry, I had to read it because it's a bit of a mouthful. MADE Working Party for short. And as you can see, I left my lace pinny behind. But that's trivialising what is a very, very important subject. So let me tell you what I've learned over the last couple of days in terms of these buzzwords. Because what I understand is that big data is being used sometimes to just mean huge, massive databases and not the predictive analytics part of the subject. And so the term we're going to use this afternoon to cover the whole piece, both the big data and the analytics, is the data science universe, okay? Everyone here knows that predictive analytics, the uses are just growing and growing and growing. It's eye-watering. We're all aware of some of the places where it started, retail, health, crime analysis, but the applications are just growing. Probably as we sit here, there will be more and more even this afternoon. And it struck me that the applications are actually only limited by our own imagination of where things can be used. And so I'm describing a really fast-changing world. And thereby is a threat, because if we don't keep pace, we'll be left behind. But with every threat, there's an opportunity. And that feeds and resonates actually with my presidential theme over the year. As you know, I've been promoting the use of our actuarial skill set, particularly in new areas. And this is absolutely core, a core key example there, because we understand numbers, we understand the implications of data, and we know how to communicate those implications. That's at the core of our skill set. So we're rightly looking at this, and we need to be playing our correct part in the whole piece. So I think it's a really, really important step. The thing is, the subject is actually huge, and it strikes me that we need to be very strategic initially. We need to look at collaboration and cross-practice working and make sure that we get a common understanding and a common aim and path forward. And so the purpose of this afternoon is to promote that shared understanding and discussion. Now, in the few minutes I had just in the council chamber in here, several people were saying, I don't know anything about it or very much. I said that when I saw that I was to sit at the top table for the first half, so I'm definitely an interloper there. But the point is that we all have to learn and find out, and if we don't know it, we find out where to where to go. And that's looking for the profession and also beyond the profession in the data science universe. See, I have learned that term. So that's enough from me, because I've already said I know nothing about the subject. And I'm going to thank, end with three thank yous. Thank you to our speakers, some of whom are here and I think others in the audience. Thank you for attending and giving up a whole afternoon. And of course, actually, a big thank you to Michael, because Michael Tripp has got this off the ground, set up the MAID Working Party. He's chair of the General Insurance Board, but this subject is not limited to general insurance. They are just one of the parts of our profession that are key stakeholders. So, Michael, thank you very much. And now I'm going to hand over to Michael, because he knows a bit more than me about what's going on anyway.
Thank you ever so much, Fiona, for those very helpful introductory words and the kind words. Thank you too, just to reiterate, to everybody for coming this afternoon. Today's programme, you will have this, hopefully you've got this on a piece of paper, but today's programme is an introduction from Fiona and myself. Then we're going to hand over to Mark Lee, who will give us an overview on what all these words mean and how some bits of them fit together. Then we're going to hand over to IBM, two august speakers from IBM, who will talk about how they see the world of computer science and the development of predictive analytics and the Internet of Things. So that's going to be, I think, a fascinating independent input. We'll then have a break for tea. You will have worked out that you're not allowed to go downstairs because, notwithstanding modern technology, it does rain sometimes. And no doubt this bit of Chancery Lane, Holborn, has a river going underneath it, so all the buildings have been suffering from rising water, but there are toilets upstairs and so on, and it hasn't affected all the escape routes that you'd know about should there be a fire. That would be ironic, fire with water, but there you go. After the tea break, when you will be given an extra time to walk upstairs if you so wish, we'll then come back and Eleanor, who is a professor at the University of East Anglia, will talk about the big research project that the profession has with the University of East Anglia, looking at big data and issues to do with health and health analytics. And then we're going to have, it's split into two, but I think we can probably merge it. We're going to have a panel session and some questions and answers, really. We want to make this as interactive as possible. Today we've done by invitation only. That may or may not be a good thing, but we thought this was actually, it's difficult to know how to get the right numbers, and in the end we had so many people wanting to be here, we didn't have enough space to put people round tables or in a more informal style, so we had to go theatre style, but we do want it interactive, and we've tried to target members of the council, members of the management board, members of all the practice boards, chairs of practice boards and members of practice boards, and of course the volunteers. So we haven't opened it up to everybody. I'm sure we want to do that at some stage, but this is really about your day and you getting something out of it for the good of the profession. You've kindly said, Fiona, you know a little bit more about it. I don't know very much more about it. In fact, I probably know less than you. I joined a very close-knit, high-quality profession in 1977. It was based on maths, and at that stage, it did work mainly in the life area and pensions, obviously pensions. I've never done pensions myself, but obviously pensions is a critical part. Has it changed? Well, of course it's changed since then. Has it changed fast enough? Well, that maybe is a bit more of a strategic question. I mean, clearly our exams now include general insurance, they include health, they include risk. We are much broader, and I saw recently that the reading materials for life actually include something on big data. So we are starting to embrace some of the changes that are going on around us. Over that time, since 1977, there have been moments in which I've been an active attender at Gyro, and moments in which my career has taken me more into management. And it was about 3 years ago the pendulum swung, so I was coming back into consulting, and there was a vacancy for a deputy chair of the GI board, and I thought, well, I'm old enough that I'd love to give something back to the profession. And lo and behold, I sort of got involved again. And at that stage, this is 3 years ago, the whole terminology, whether it's predictive analytics, data science, whatever you want to call it, was, I put down here, sloshing around. It was just such a big thing that nobody within the profession really quite knew where it should rest. You know, was it research and thought leadership? Was it the council? Was it the management board? Was it general insurance? Where should it be picked up? And there's also sloshing around at that time the question about, so what is actuarial? What is actuarial science? You know, in one extreme, actuarial is anything that an actuary does. That's one way it's defined, and the regulations sometimes rely on that. But I sort of listened to what people said, and four thoughts went through the mind, and these may not be the right thoughts, but clearly mathematics and modelling, all the modern statistics, all the modern Bayesian thinking must be at the heart of what we do. Domain insights, you know, we really do understand life insurance, pensions, general insurance, health. That understanding, the practicality, it really adds something to the theoretical stuff. Expert judgment and thinking longer term is another aspect, I think, of what makes us what we are. And then finally, professional regulation, thinking in the public interest. And I don't think, personally, it's any one of those four in isolation that makes us actuaries. I think it is actually all four in totality. But that may be a question for later on. And clearly, where does big data, where does predictive analytics, where does data science come in? The other thing that happened when I first came onto the GI board was people were talking then about GLMs. Generalised linear models have been used, certainly in general insurance, since probably the 1980s, when people like Stuart Coutts and Michael Brockman and so on started pushing them as a way of doing predictions and predictive analytics in general insurance. But 3 years ago, people were saying, hold on a moment, you know, we're still focusing too much on GLMs, and there's a real risk, a real threat, that we've become a one-trick pony, and we need to do something about it. Time passed. At the start of this year, I was innocently picking up the baton to become chair of the board when a very nice lady, Jill, sitting at the back there, phoned me and said, Michael, what do you think about the idea of a big data working party? And I can't remember what I said, Jill, but I said, whatever we do, yes, all right, we're up for it. I'm not an expert, but I will make something happen that is clearly important. And if we do it, two or three things. One, it must not be general insurance. It's got to be cross-practice. Whatever we do, it's got to be across the whole piece. You know, at the very least, whatever problems we're involved with now as a profession, let's, for heaven's sake, embrace all the modern methodologies, all the modern techniques, and make sure that the problems we're involved with, we solve and we help people with as professionally as we possibly can, given the world that we live in. So that's got to be cross-practice, and it's got to be good for us. And the second thing I said is we must avoid buzzwords. And we've already had a bit of this, and I think it's going to be a theme this afternoon. And I'm sorry, it was just an attempt to avoid any buzzword that we came up with, modelling, analytics and information from data. I wasn't trying to be politically incorrect or sexist. I really wasn't. But you know, we are where we are, and we'll progress. And one of the things this afternoon we might, as a profession, start to think about is what's our common terminology? What's our common set of words that we will all use and understand what they mean? And that's where the best we came up with was the data science universe. But when we come to the discussion, maybe there'll be room for a bit of conversation about that. So the journey started. In January, we had 40-plus volunteers. We had a kick-off meeting here in Staple Inn. We formed a steering team. Later on in the programme, the steering team will introduce themselves and talk about the four work streams that we've now got. We've organised ourselves around research. I won't say too much because we will elaborate on this later on. How we use these new tools and techniques for current problems, what these new tools and techniques mean for us as a profession, and what we should maybe think about doing in a wider sense, other domains maybe, or broader subjects, and what does it mean for us as a profession. So we'll talk more about that in the second half of the afternoon. I would just end, before handing over to Mark Lee, with the objectives for today. I think it's important that we have some learning objectives, and these have been sort of sloshed around a little bit, but really it's about... Number one is, let's have a conversation, let's start a conversation, or let's carry on and give more emphasis to a conversation about what is the profession doing with all this stuff? What should it? What is it doing? Is it doing enough? Is it doing it fast enough? What should it do? What more can it do? Is it a threat? Is it an opportunity? How are we going to deal with it? So I hope we can promote that subject and get some conversation going around that. Number two, I'm not doing this in order, so I'm sorry, but it's getting your views on the table. Where would you like the profession to go? And we'll launch a pilot survey just to get some feedback from everybody here, but we may want to build on that. So, the council, the profession, needs to give lead, but it also needs to be responsive to its members as well. So that interaction, I think, is important. And what are the consequences for doing nothing, or the consequences for adapting and really going for it? I did have up there that everybody in this room will be at a different stage in their understanding about this whole subject. So I hope collectively we get some shared language, some shared semantics, but also wherever you are in your own personal journey, and some people will be well ahead of others, that you can get something out this afternoon. So wherever you're at, your own understanding takes a notch forward. And above all, that as a result of this, we help our profession as a whole work together so that we are more coordinated, more cohesive, more determined about how we use the world around us for the greater good of the society that we serve. So I think that's enough of an introduction from me. I'm going to introduce now Mark Lee. I saw Mark do a presentation at SIGI. So how many people in here know what SIGI stands for? So that means about half the people here are general insurance actuaries. This really has to be cross. SIGI is current issues in general insurance. So, and if you're a life actuary, you might have worked that out. I don't know what the equivalent would be in pensions. Fiona will tell us, I'm sure. But wherever you're at, this I found was a really interesting overview presentation. Mark was at the University of Oxford, I think, and did his PhD, and this sounds really impressive, in theoretical quantum physics. So I immediately bowed down. But I found that this overview about the world we're looking at, Mark, was you put it so clearly, and I just thought it was such a really helpful platform for everybody that we thank you for giving up your time, the consulting work that you do. I think it's your own business that you're running, or at least you'll tell us more in a second. But you've given up your time and you're sharing, and we need to do as much sharing as possible so we don't keep these things to ourselves, because that's for the greater good. But I just welcome Mark to give us an introduction to the whole subject.
Right, so thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I hope the bar hasn't been set too high with your expectations. But I'd like to try to introduce all the terms that are bandied around to do with data science, how they fit together in some way, and talk a little bit about some of the concepts which are important to bear in mind if you were to use some of these techniques, particularly with a sort of bias towards the machine learning aspects. And, of course, to talk about the implications of these techniques for the insurance industry and the actuarial profession as a whole. So I'm going to start by trying to plot a map of this universe. And for context, I'll start with a traditional actuarial task, that of personal lines pricing. We start with a so-called small data set, or traditional data set, which can in practice be quite large, prior claims data. We put that into a GLM, and the GLM generates a predictive model. The predictive model gives us some insight into the business, in particular here in terms of a rating model. But that process of gaining some insight from data is really what data science is about. So this is very much a data science job. Now, as Michael said, this is GLMs have been used to do this for almost three decades now. Very successfully, and the success is due to a number of factors, but one of which is that by modern computational standards, they're computationally easy, which means 30 years ago they were computationally tractable. Okay. Computers have come on a long way in 30 years, and those modern computers lead to some new opportunities. One of which is the fact that these computers are networked together. They're ubiquitous, they're in your pocket, they're in your home, they're in the supermarket tills, they're in your car. Those computers can generate an awful lot of data because they're networked together. They can collate that data and sort that data. So there's the opportunity there to have a large amount of data to use, with lots of problems associated with it as well. Data can be unstructured, very difficult to deal with. I'm sure we'll hear more about that later on today. So ideally, having got this big data set, what you'd really like to do is put it into a supervised learning routine, of which GLMs are a subset, in order to get a better predictive model. Okay, that would be the desire. Now, because these can be very large data sets or unstructured and have other problems, this is now a computationally challenging problem by modern standards. Challenging but tractable. So that's big data. There's another opportunity here, which is maybe occasionally overlooked, certainly in the name big data, it doesn't seem to appear, which is that you might not need a big data set necessarily. Modern computers can also be used to analyze your small traditional data set using more computationally challenging supervised learning algorithms. I'll return to a definition of supervised learning in a moment. And so the idea is that maybe the traditional data that you have can, using these more computationally challenging algorithms, may be able to give a better predictive model than GLMs. Okay, to return to big data, say you've got a big data set, one of the other things you might like to do with your data is to just understand the data. And a common method for doing that is data visualization. That helps you understand the data, the structure behind it, and that can give insight in its own right. The problem with data visualization is that it can be a very labor-intensive process and can be quite difficult in high dimensions. So it would be nice to leverage the power of modern computers to help understand the data. And sure enough, there's an array of computational algorithms known as unsupervised learning algorithms, which can be used to help you understand the data. There's, of course, a feedback loop here. Once you understand the data better, you may be able to use that understanding to better enhance your supervised learning routine and therefore better come out with a better predictive model. Now, these two categories of supervised and unsupervised learning are often lumped together under the title machine learning. The machine or the computer learns by exposure to the data. And another term which is quite commonly used is data mining. When people talk about data mining, they're often talking about the bottom half of this diagram. So that's my map of the data science universe. I should caveat it with the fact that many of these boundaries are blurred or overlap, and there are many things I've had to leave off here, but hopefully it gives you some flavor of the universe. I'm going to focus on machine learning, particularly today. And just before we move away from the map, I just want to put the names to some of these algorithms that I've talked to, just to put them in context. I don't have any time to really go into any details. But within supervised learning, modern routines include things like neural networks, which were used as the basis of Google's AlphaGo machine, which just beat a human Go champion you might have heard about a couple of months ago. There are tree-based methods, such as random forests and boosted trees. You probably used a boosted tree model if you've used a digital camera which has face recognition. GLMs can be enhanced by regularized linear models. Then there are techniques such as k-nearest neighbors and support vector machines. Unsupervised learning, on the other hand, often looks at the structures involved in the data. For example, tries to cluster the data by means of things like k-means clustering and hierarchical trees. Or it tries to represent the data in some other manner, for example, using principal components analysis. Now, this is by no means a definitive list, but this is some of the more common techniques. Okay, so let me now go back to supervised and unsupervised learning and just contrast them. Oh, I should mention as well, there's an overlap. Neural networks, for example, can be used for unsupervised learning as well. But let me look at these categories again, supervised learning versus unsupervised learning. Supervised learning is for data with a dependent variable or classification. A dependent variable might be a claim severity or a claim frequency. Dependent classification might be whether a claim is fraudulent or non-fraudulent. Whatever case, you've got a dependent variable that you want to predict on eventually. So we start with some training data, which is some prior claims data, for example, with that dependent variable included. We put it into a learning algorithm, and the learning algorithm outputs a model. The model is predictive in the sense that if I start with some new data which doesn't have that dependent variable, the model will make a prediction of that variable. The model can be transparent and easy to understand or black box-like, depending upon the details of the learning algorithm. Unsupervised learning, in contrast, is for data exploration only. There is no dependent variable. We start with some data, we put it into an algorithm, and the algorithm generates some new representation of that data. So to give you a toy model of that, let's start on the left-hand side with supervised learning. We start with a bunch of pictures of cats and dogs, each labeled cat or dog. We put that into our learning algorithm, and that generates a predictive model. The predictive model now, we can pass a picture of a pet, and we hope that the model makes a prediction, in this case, cat. Okay? On the right-hand side, in contrast, we start with just a bunch of pictures of animals without any labels. We put them through the algorithm, and the algorithm comes up with some new structure. It potentially could separate them into cats and dogs, but it could equally likely separate them by colour of pet, or more likely it's going to separate them by some very complicated mechanism. But it gives you some idea of which pictures are close to each other or similar to each other and which are further apart. So I'm going to focus now on the supervised learning aspect, because that is probably more akin to many of the traditional actuarial jobs, and talk a little bit about how you choose the algorithm that you want to use. So there are many different things you might want to bear in mind. I've plotted two of them on this axis. Oh, sorry, in this plot. On the y-axis here, we've got how flexible your model is to fitting different shapes of data. And on the x-axis, we've got how easy it is to understand your model, how interpretable the output is. So linear models, for example, are very easy to interpret, but they're quite inflexible. They only fit models with a linear relationship. GLMs enhance that by using the link function, and they're still quite interpretable. Then we have models like single trees, which are quite flexible and reasonably easy to interpret. We have models such as k-nearest neighbors, which can span a range of flexibilities, but are less interpretable. And then we have a number of very powerful techniques, which are very flexible, such as forests, neural networks, and support vector machines, but whose interpretability is maybe substantially lower. And these are more black box-like. I should emphasize these are never actually a black box. You can always work out exactly what is going on. However, it may be so complicated that you don't really gain anything by doing so. Okay, so say you've chosen an algorithm based on your problem. You're not finished yet. Now you need to start tuning your algorithm. These are really families of algorithms. And one of the things you need to worry about is the bias variance trade-off. If you have a predictive model, you can often break apart the error in that predictive model into the irreducible error, the bias, and the variance. The irreducible error comes from the random noise underlying the data. The bias comes from whether the assumptions of the model fit the underlying process. So, for example, a linear model is very strongly biased if there's non-linear behavior in the data. And the variance is the variability of the model if you train it on different random subsets of the data. In other words, how much your model has overfit to the random noise in your data. So these are equivalent to process error, model error, and parameter error. Okay. Now, you can't do anything about the first term. That's just there. But you can try to combat bias, for example, by adding model complexity if you have a problem with high bias. On the other hand, if you have a problem with high variance, you need to reduce your model complexity. Obviously, you can't do both of these at the same time, so that leads to a trade-off. You end up with a classic shape of a complexity versus error diagram like this, where there's a sweet spot. And you really need to tune your model in order to find that sweet spot to get a good predictive model. How do you do that tuning? Well, if we go back to the slide, all of these algorithms depend on a number of hyperparameters which control how the algorithm works. And by tuning those hyperparameters, you can often tune the complexity of your model and find it. So the task comes down to finding the right hyperparameters in your algorithm to get a good predictive model. Okay, so which algorithm is best? Well, all algorithms have some bias. And there's actually a mathematical theorem, the no-free-lunch theorem, which states that no algorithm can be best when considered over all classes of problems. So you may well find, however, that certain methods work well for certain classes of problems. And the best result is often going to be an aggregate of different methods. So in other words, it depends. And human judgment is very much required. So how do these techniques impact on insurers and actuaries? Well, for insurers, as I mentioned before, we have new data sources, telematics for motor insurance. Health insurers are pricing based on step counts on your phone. So there are new data sources. They have implications for better models. There are also more powerful algorithms, more computationally challenging algorithms at least. Can GLMs keep up with those algorithms? Can you gain a competitive advantage from using those algorithms? And you might not need particularly large data sets, so quite possibly even insurers with comparatively smaller data sets like London Market players may be able to take advantage of these techniques. How does it impact the actuarial profession? So the first question, I guess, was, will actuaries be replaced by machines or computer scientists? Well, I hope if I convey one thing today, it's that these techniques are really just advanced tools for statistically and technically minded people, and human judgment is very much required. So certainly I don't see actuaries being replaced by computer science, by machines. Nonetheless, these techniques can be can give powerful predictive performance, and so if actuaries incorporate these techniques along with their existing skill set, particularly the business acumen and the respect that the profession has, I think, within the business community, then there's a great opportunity here, as Fiona alluded to before, for actuaries to really leverage these techniques and make some gains. But the data scientist career is really taking off, and so I see an opportunity and a threat. You know, if actuaries don't adapt some of these techniques, the relevant ones at least, or at least interrogate these techniques properly, then I see issues. But I do see a lot of potential for the actuarial profession as a whole. So just to leave you with some references, I work for Insight Risk Consulting. We're a small consultancy with there's five of us in the office, and we mainly use R and Python platforms for our data science. If you're interested in reading more about any of these algorithms, then there's an excellent free ebook online, this Introduction to Statistical Learning, and there's a LinkedIn group, Data Science for Insurers group, if anyone's interested. Thank you very much.
Thank you ever so much, Mark. That was just as good as the first time I heard it, and I learned a little bit more as well. Thank you. We will keep questions and answers for later on in the afternoon, so we're going to hand straight on now to the two speakers from IBM, and we really appreciate giving up the time. Graham Jackson on my immediate left has been involved in insurance, I think, for a long time by looking at this.
Probably longer than you.
Probably longer than me. we'll discuss that over a pint of beer later on then. But Graham, specialisms in insurance have been around business transformation, particular focus on underwriting, actuarial pricing, reinsurance and claims. But more recently, you've been, I think, in the UK with the Watson Cognitive Solutions, you know, leveraging unstructured claims data and so on. Many people here will at least have heard of that, I think. And also an expert in robotics and the Internet of Things. Stephen, I think you're going to kick us off, is also an associate partner in IBM's Cognitive Solutions insurance practice. I think it says here you've spent most of your career working in financial services, so maybe it's a bit broader than just general insurance, which is, I think, is really important for us. More recently, customer projects, data analytics, linking to regulatory reporting, Solvency II, customer insight, data warehouse, and so on. So I think between the two of you, we're going to have a fascinating input. You may want to add a little bit more about yourself, Stephen, but we're looking forward to the next 45 minutes or so to really lead us into our tea break.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you. So we're going to change direction slightly from Mark's session. It'll be a slightly higher level piece to introduce you a bit to the topic of big data. And then Graham will go on to cognitive and IoT. So I want to start with a bit of context setting, I think, in terms of where we are in the industry generally and where the marketplace is. Whilst I know from the work that I've been doing over the last few years, we've been heads down on Solvency II, outside in the world, things have been changing. So we've seen that as customers, we've changed. We're very fussy now. We want insurers and banks to be able to treat us as individuals, be very personalised with the service they provide us, and know what we want, when we want, and how to deliver that to us. So as consumers, we've become a lot fussier. Aside from that, we've also had this explosion of data. So since the smartphone came in, since social media started, suddenly there's much, much more data. It's not all about the internal structured data. All that other data, which people now refer to as dark data, that's out there. So data that exists, that people potentially don't use yet or haven't been made aware of its uses. I was at an event last week and someone said that anything that can be rated will be rated now. So as consumers, whether it's on TripAdvisor or something else, there's opinions out there. And how do you use that data to influence how you serve that customer in the future or what the risk is associated to that customer? So there's new data sources out there that people are beginning to think about. And outside of the insurance industry, we're seeing more people use that data already. And I think there's opportunities here. So, and of course, and Graham will come on to changing risks and Internet of Things and how that may change how you have to underwrite and price products in the future. So, of course, with that disruption, we're already seeing, and I know Fiona mentioned about opportunities and threats, people are already going, brilliant, there's an opportunity for me. And we know, and I'm sure all of us or some of us have already used the likes of Airbnb and Uber. So, you know, we're seeing the likes of Airbnb, who own absolutely no real estate at all, are going out and becoming the top real estate agent in the world by being able to sell rooms to the likes of you and I to go and stay in. Now, they're very successful because they own the customer. They own the portal into the customer. They don't care who owns the real estate, but they're able to manage the customer and know what their needs are and their behaviours are. The same with Uber. I was in the US last week in San Francisco. My wife's never used Uber. And she was amazed how I just tapped twice and I got a taxi waiting outside. And when we got to the airport, I didn't have to give the guy any money. It was all covered. It was all done. And the ability to move the traditional black cab out, and we know that there's problems with that here and in Paris, but suddenly Uber, who own no taxis, own the customer. They have the data. They have the behavioural data. They know when I go onto the app what I'm looking at, where I'm potentially going to. So when I went in San Francisco, they knew the chances are I'm going to the airport before I'd even put that as my destination. So they're using that data to predict where I might want to go based on my previous behaviour. So we're seeing organisations that don't own assets starting to want to own the customer and take that forward. So we're seeing disruption happen and people taking that forward. And of course, the big question is, when's that going to happen to insurance and who's going to do it? And we see some of that with IoT, we see some of that with telematics, and Graham will touch a bit on that. But we haven't seen that to the level of an Uber or an Airbnb to date. So then you think about, well, what processes within insurance could be disrupted or transformed or changed based on these new sources of data? I do a bit of work on customer insight in marketing, and they're very keen to use more data that's outside of the organisation, and I'll come back to that in a bit. So can I use the social media stuff? Can I trust that data? Can I use other sources of data, such as weather data, to influence how I decide, how I engage with people, or how I underwrite things? So there's opportunity within insurance to just change and optimise and make the processes a little bit more efficient. So we were asked to come and talk about big data and analytics. Now, 3 years ago, we would have talked about these things, which are the four Vs. Now, Doug Laney from Gartner came up with the three Vs, and we've added one on the back of that. Now, for 3 years, we haven't talked about it. We don't talk big data anymore. 3 years ago, it was a nightmare. You get into a conversation about these four Vs, so volume, variety, velocity, and veracity, and you go to events, and you'd spend hours talking about the merits of volume. Well, volume's of no relevance to insurance. We don't have big data. We've got broad data, so variety's more important to us. And actually, is velocity important? How often do we need to respond in near real time to data coming into our organisation? So we go round the loop on the merits of the Vs. And actually, what we wouldn't be talking about is, what's the business value behind doing big data? And I think by the end of 2013, mid-2014, people stopped talking about big data, and that term has disappeared. And what we see now is people want to talk more about the analytics and the stuff that you guys were talking about just now. And it's more about that detail and the value you can get from it. But I mean, these four Vs, yes, they're useful. So do I know whether I've got a big, broad data set and high volume? From a variety, am I using my internal, my external sources, my structured, my unstructured? And it helps you define what data you might want to use. Velocity, data in motion. Do I need to respond as something happens, whether that's from a claim or whether I'm seeing a consumer, a customer of mine, have a need for something new or a change to an existing product that they have with us? And then veracity, which is the uncertainty in the data, the quality of the data that you have. But we don't talk about those anymore, so I'm going to move on. So instead, what we see is people want to talk about the different types of analytics. So descriptive analytics, what's happened in the past, what have people done, still really important to insurance. So I know that my claims history is really important for what I'm going to do in the future, because that's going to have an impact on the risk. But as Mark said, when now people are looking at predictive analytics. But how can I use technology and data in a different way to maybe change how I do that already today? And then I did a bit of work last year with an organisation in Europe on customer insight, and it got to prescriptive analytics. So not only do I want to score a customer based on their propensity to need something, I want to know what I should be doing based on that score. What is the action that I should be taking on the back of it? So we're seeing organisations now looking to do predictive and prescriptive analytics. And then there's this new one at the top, cognitive, which seems to be, well, certainly Graham and I are finding, is the hot buzzword for us this year around people wanting to do things with natural language, wanting to be able to reason and interpret with English, with documents, with speech, and advise people where you may not need an individual. And I'm not going to steal Graham's thunder. Graham's going to come on to that in a bit more detail a bit later on. But we're seeing companies are now looking on the back of the Solvency II landscape, how do we differentiate? What can we do differently, and how do we use analytics to allow us to do that? Some people are already doing it, and I'll go through some of the non-insurance examples in a minute. One of our studies that we do every year is with the Institute of Business Value, is a research function of ours. And last year, we did a research of what people are doing with big data. And you might be able to see here, 71% of people are using it to develop new products, looking to think, how can I use that data to create something different that someone hasn't got already, or a different product in the marketplace? And we've seen a bit of that with telematics, but we are now seeing much, much more attention to how can I get a different solution to the market that no other insurer's got. And we've seen a lot of movement in that space, certainly in the UK this year. And then if you look, some of the examples that we see already, Liverpool Victoria have bought into a startup company called Wealth Wizards, and they're looking to take guidance for retirement planning to the market, which is just aiding people based on the pot of money they've got and think about the options that they've got for retirement. Tokio Marine, and I know someone's here from Tokio Marine, so I better be careful what I say, but how to predict and help on potential medical illnesses that are coming up and spot them early and use that data to help spot that and then give better guidance to the customer. The last one's quite interesting. If you think about Airbnb and Uber, these guys, which I believe are Swiss, NIP, I think it's pronounced, provide you an app to store all your policies in one place. So where suddenly you as an insurer think you own the customer, suddenly you've got someone above that who's saying, I don't care who you bought your insurance through, I've got an app that will allow you to bring it all together. And they suddenly know your spread of insurance across your different providers, and they've got access to you and what you look at and what you do through that app. So suddenly you've got an Uber, Airbnb-style app that's going to sit across their policies. So we're seeing people starting to do this in insurance. But insurance isn't ahead of the market. Here's some examples here that I'll just pull out some of them on, where we are seeing people that are, I would say, a bit further down the track. I'm a big sports fan, so I had to have a couple of these in here. So if you look at Red Bull Racing in Formula One, this data science, big data analytics, is nothing new to these guys. They rely on that every weekend there's a race, and they have done for years. So if you think they've got over 200 sensors on a Formula One car, they know when you need to come in and change your tyres. They bring in external weather data, so they know if it's going to rain as you're going round. What impact's that going to have on your lap time? When do I need to change your tyres? And they do all of this for race optimization. They also use that data to understand where can you quicken up on which corner to get on pole. So they've been doing that for years. They don't need data science. They've had it for a very long time. Look at England Rugby. They use historical game data to do keys to the game, predictions for how England can beat the competition. So they know from when England have played Scotland before, there's three key things that England need to do to get right in order to beat Scotland. If they fulfil them, they're not saying that they will beat Scotland, but there's a greater chance that England will beat Scotland if they hit their three keys to the game, and vice versa. So they know what Scotland need to do to beat England and how to prevent that. So England RFU, who are a traditional organisation, are beginning to look at the data to impact the player performance. And also, you might know that when the players are on the pitch, they've got these tags in the back of their shirts. That's checking their performance on an individual player basis. And they know from game to game when they're at peak performance and when they're getting tired and when they're dropping off. They also know when someone's likely to come down with a cold, because in training, they see that they're below par on their performance. So they're beginning to use data to get a competitive edge against the competition. You look at the likes of Nationwide Insurance in the US, they're looking to bring in customer interaction data to do behavioural-based customer insight, to target their customers better and understand their need rather than send them the 10% off in the post on the next policy. So they're trying to get closer to their customer. Tesco's a good example. Tesco doing price optimization. They've been hit massively by Amazon. So they go out and they do screen scraping, they get the competition's data, and they understand where they should be pricing white goods, televisions, etc. And they have prescriptive analytics in there that says, actually, you know, based on something that's moving, we'll automatically change our price. So there's lots of stuff going on in different industries at the moment. Even Dublin. Dublin are using sensors on buses to understand flow of traffic in the city and then redirect people based on where there's traffic queues when traffic should be going faster. So we're seeing lots of use of data already happening in other industries. The challenge is, how do you then apply that to this industry? So what I wanted to do was turn it round to, well, it's all right, we can talk about data, you can talk about that's all really exciting. What do you need to do to get your organisation set up correctly in order to do big data analytics in the right way? And there's a number of different areas that I think insurers need to address in order to get that right. So if you think organisationally, I know from the work that I've done with insurers that when it comes to data and analytics, it's quite federated, if I'm being polite. So you end up with, I don't know, if I go to a GI and a life insurer, you'll find that the GI will have their own data, the life insurer will have their own data, and never will the two come together. They'll have their own teams of people, and they're led by their own people, and they don't share. And we know that, and that's for obvious reasons. But now we're seeing that there's a need to try and think, how do we pull it together? How do we reduce duplication of data across the organisation for the benefit of us managing risk and for our consumer to get the best benefit? So we're seeing some changes come in. So chief data officer. So I know that when people are talking about who owns data, who owns the resources, there can often be political issues within organisations. So what we see is that this role now, the chief data officer, which is, I guess, about 8 or 10 years old, came in initially on the west coast of the US. People like Yahoo came in. We've seen banks come in over the last 6 years, and now we're seeing insurers putting in head of data or chief data officer. And there's normally two types of chief data officer. One that wants to govern and make sure that we protect the asset of data, which is really important, and one that wants to transform. So who's going to come in and bring in the analytics and drive the agenda on analytics? So we're seeing one or the other, depending on where people are in the life cycle. Then secondly is the data science team, the data science community, which clearly you need to be able to execute on data analytics with a team of people. Now, in my work over the last couple of years, what I've seen is clearly with actuaries and people that sit in marketing functions, people are already doing elements of this job already. So what we see within insurance is that we don't see a centralized data science function that gets created or with people that can do the work that Mark was talking about. What we see is a hub and spoke model where we see pockets of excellence exist in parts of the business with a centralized function there to support them. But what we're seeing is now these functions are becoming more commonplace within insurance. Alongside people, process, leadership, you also need to make sure that you've got the right ability to store that data and action on that data. So we're seeing people now looking to address their future state architecture to be able to cover those analytical areas I mentioned earlier on around descriptive and predictive. And with those different data sources that are available, traditional data warehouses just don't cut it. One, they take too long to implement, and two, they very rarely deliver the value. So what we're seeing is people want to think about landing zones, exploration zones, where the data remains in its raw format, and then the ability to put these tools on top to do the algorithms and the modelling that Mark was talking about. So we're seeing an impatient workforce, and this is not insurance, this is across the board. People that want to be able to have access to that data early rather than wait 3 years. You can't wait 3 years this day and age. So we're seeing people now addressing their traditional data architecture to evolve that to enable unstructured data to come in, whether that's photos, whether that's videos, whether that's documents, to support it alongside the traditional structured data that you already have. And then on the right-hand side here, changing in tooling, the data visualization that was mentioned. People are looking for newer, quicker ways of analyzing that data that's not a spreadsheet. I know that might be sacrilege in the presence of actuaries, but you know, how can I look and analyze data in a newer, quicker way using whether it's a SAS Visual Analytics, whether it's a Tableau, whether it's a Watson Analytics, any of those tools that allow you to analyze that much quicker. So we're seeing new tools coming onto the market as well. Of course, if you've got a nice new shiny data architecture, I need to be able to have data in there. And what I'm seeing, which I think is really interesting, is a change in behavior. We're seeing organizations wanting to partner with other organizations. We're seeing this broad range of data exists that actually I may not need to bring into my organization. I might need just to have an API call out to it to get that data when I need it. But I know that there are partners out there that have got data that I need. It could be simply down to the fact it's a telematics service provider, or it could be a social media feed that actually I need to get that data on. Or if you look at weather, we own the weather company, and you know they get 22 billion weather forecasts made every day. Well, I don't want to store all of that data in my database, so I want to be able to call out to that as and when I need it. So we see that there is growing partnerships of data occurring across the industry. However, you don't go to jail if you do some nice new shiny things with analytics. You will go to jail if you don't protect your data. So we then have, unfortunately, the flip side of the nice new shiny analytics, which is how do I protect my data from breaches, from cybersecurity risk? And not in insurance, but 2 years ago, Barclays got fined £38 million for not separating their customer data from their internal data. So we know that the FCA will fine people if they get their data management wrong and they don't protect it. So on the flip side, I'm seeing a lot of people saying, how do I protect that asset before I look to do the nice new shiny things on the top of that? With one eye on GDPR. So GDPR, which was signed off last month, in 2 years' time, people have got to have their data protected or the personal information protected. So when you bring data into your organisation, and you might use that for underwriting or for pricing a policy for a customer, should I then pass that to marketing for other functions? Or if marketing have got that data, should I pass it to actuarial for their analysis? Am I using that data for the intended purpose it was brought into the organisation for? Am I protecting the consumer's rights? Or the way I think of it is, if I'm a consumer and I give that data to you guys, are you using it for the reason I gave it to you? And is it a fair use of that data? Now, this is going to be self-policed, I understand, but we're seeing people now using their time between now and 2018 to think about how do I get the foundations of data right whilst also trying to execute the analytics at the same time. So it's quite an interesting time at the moment. And then, of course, alongside that, and some of that stuff's not new, records management, how long do I retain data for? When should I archive that data? There's always been the legal responsibilities. There's a business need, and then there's the IT cost, which is how do I reduce my spend on storage? So there's always been that need around that. And what we see is now people are looking at data governance, information retention, and trying to get those foundations in place correctly now so that you can do the exploitation of data. I'm sorry I've had to bring it back down to privacy and protection, but this is the key thing. We get this bit right, the exploitation piece will come much easier. I'm going to hand over to Graham, who'll talk a bit more about the exciting stuff on cognitive and IoT. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve, and good afternoon, all. I'd have to say, I remember sitting in Adelaide and signing my application form to become an Institute of Actuaries student, and I was quite captivated by Staple Inn Hall. Not the normal naming conventions in Australia, and So it became part of my bucket list to come and see it. So today is a removal of something from my bucket list, and very pleased to be here. You'll see from what Steve has said that there is quite a lot of connection between some of the things that he's talking about and cognitive computing. And if I've had any number of discussions over the last 6 months about cognitive computing, there is quite a lot of different interpretations of it, perceptions of what it can do, and I would say it's only probably secondary to blockchain in the areas that people don't really have a common understanding. So I guess in its very simple form, we actually look at cognitive versus traditional applications around these three areas: understanding, reasoning, and learning. And a key part of the cognitive argument is around natural language processing. So there is a heavy focus at the front end of the process in being able to handle any type of interaction in the way that people speak differently, they write differently, etc. And it's the ability to actually interpret the intent of the conversation and therefore take that into a cognitive solution which is trained and formed out of what we would call a corpus of knowledge. So the whole concept of this is that you've got unstructured communication at the front end in terms of natural language processing. You've got large corpuses of information in unstructured form, heavily supported by some of the algorithms that we talked about before, so that you don't need to actually have structured data in the end-to-end process. Now, I guess most of you, if not all, will have heard about IBM's investment in Watson. So IBM doesn't make decisions lightly, and in fact, the Watson division about 3 years ago became the first new division of IBM. It's that important, and it's part of the vision of how we think people will interact, the data that is used to actually support those interactions, how those relationships can be exploited. But it's all fundamentally based around unstructured interaction, unstructured data, supported by the algorithmic models that actually give you the outcome. Now, this was all tested with the game of Jeopardy in the US, which essentially is the number one quiz game, where IBM ingested virtually every encyclopedia known to man and competed in real time with the two top champions of America. Now, that's not your average solution for insurance, but it was to absolutely make the point that the ability to interpret unstructured data in real time against large corpuses of information, that is the extent of the capability. Then the question becomes, what are the use cases that are relevant to any particular scenario? The other point is that there is no absolute answer in a cognitive world. So the whole concept is, I will interpret what I think I'm being asked, I will refer to my corpus of information, and I will form a view of what the answers are. And so there is a sort of probabilistic view is to say, oh, I've never heard of this before, I don't think I'll answer it, as opposed to, yes, I've seen this a million times before and I'm 95% confident. And that's how it participated in the quiz show, and that's essentially how cognitive solutions actually support people who are actually using that capability. As Steve has mentioned, that the ability to actually use these cognitive solutions actually requires a lot of data. And I sort of think of data being internal and external, and most insurers are focused in on their internal data. There is external data that has existed for a long time, like Twitter and what have you, but the ability to actually analyse that unstructured data in a useful way in a cognitive environment is something that is new. And so you see these sorts of data sources that some are using by accessing in a structured way. Some of them are about, well, actually, can I ingest a whole heap of Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds and those sorts of things and apply my natural language processing capability to actually work out what sentiments are being expressed, what the customer's personality is, etc. And that is the difference about cognitive solutions. But clearly, not every insurer can sit around, or any organisation can sit around and say, I'm going to bring all of those capabilities into my organisation. That just doesn't make sense. And so what has emerged, I suppose, even outside of the cognitive world, more and more organisations are relying on external data. They have architectures, system architectures and infrastructures that enable very rapid use of APIs to actually access data, etc. I think the cognitive world has actually just accelerated the process, and so we see here lots of different what are called Watson APIs. So I don't know whether any of you have used a Watson API, but it's an interesting question as actuaries. You know, do you get on the front foot and say, actually, there is a lot of data here that we could use, or are you actually relying on people in the marketing area or the customer servicing area to actually create the demand? My preference, I think, would be is for the actuaries to actually be familiar with all of this stuff, actually use it, because you know, you can sign on to IBM Bluemix. You can get 30 days free. Not often you get something out of IBM for nothing, I'd have to say. But you can actually very quickly write bits of code that actually can access these APIs. And I'll give you a couple of examples of where we've done this. So an important part of this is natural language classifier. This is trying to interpret an interface from a customer. So some of the stuff that we've been looking at is to say, but, you know, customers ask the same sort of questions a lot of the time. Can we actually determine the intent and actually automatically respond with the customer either in real time or in response to an email, etc., using classification services? Personality insights. We've used this a few times. This is basically an API. There's a reference on this slide here where you can actually go on and use it yourself. If you want to write at least 100 words about something that you think is important, have a go. And I've offered people in various sessions, give me 100 words that you've written on something or other. And you can use the Watson API to actually drive a personality profile. So it'll tell you from the way you write and what you say, and using its natural language processing technique, what sort of person you are. So you could imagine actually using that in a customer interface, is to say, I'm not going to have the same script for a customer. You know, if they are cranky or they are uncertain or whatever, I need to have a different approach. So, but a lot of this is actually informed by actually accessing through Watson APIs these sorts of utilities. So it's an important part of the cognitive journey. So I guess in the round, it's actually a lot of this organised data, which is what Steve does for a living, as best as I can tell, and there is these Watson APIs that we've just described. The other part to this is I think there is an argument for expanding the organised data. So I take, for example, you've got a claim system, you've got all the claims data that people put into the system. There's a medical report that comes in with an injury claim, but that data is not really available other than in a PDF file or something. So I think the answer to this also is to expand the organised data in the organisation. So some of those tools are not so much natural language processing, cognitive tools. They are what I would call technical type tools. And what I find is interesting is that the cognitive world is probably more addressed to process and interaction and driving, creating value through those interactions. The other side to it is actually what value can I get from improved technical data? And one of the areas we looked at was particularly around motor claims in the UK, MOJ claims, absolute basket case in the UK versus the rest of Europe. And what we were looking for was to how we could actually help claims handlers settle claims more consistently, more fairly, by actually providing them with more data around claims, precedent claims, settlements, etc. And so what we did was we actually took some of the one of the Watson tools, used its natural language processing capability, and created annotators for medical reports, and then converted all of the content of that those medical reports into structured data, which actually then informed some of the models that we were using for likeness. Now, one of the things I think is really important of all of this is, you know, you don't actually know what you don't know. And that's part of the excitement of actually being at the forefront of the thinking in your organisation or wherever, is how can I actually interpret this data? How can I extrapolate from one situation to another and actually develop a different proposition? So the inspiration actually for the injury claims management exercise that we did where we actually created another 40-odd structured data items on top of about 60-odd that had come out of the claims system. Big increase. And then we sort of had a big discussion about, well, what are the models that we should use? So in the end, we used the hierarchical tree models, and we used Euclidean distance to actually measure closeness of claims, etc. And so, but did we know we were going to do that at the start? To be fair, no. But that's the important part of this, is you actually you need to learn as you go along. But the inspiration for all of this was, we actually saw an oncology advisor, which you see on YouTube as one of the IBM Watson solutions. It was a specialist who'd been at university, probably hadn't read another medical journal in his life since then. He was treating a breast cancer patient, and he was using Watson's cognitive capability to drill down into all of these medical literature and case studies and what have you, and then came back with treatments and constraints on treatments and likelihoods of success. And we were saying, well, actually, isn't that the same as a claims handler handling an injury claim, using a set of data, using a set of precedent settlements? So I think it's important when we actually look at these technologies to actually extrapolate from the successes in one area to actually doing something different in another area. So it's certainly one of the experiences that we've learned. This example here, this is just an example of taking a speech, taking your 100 words, taking Martin Luther King's words, and actually developing a profile. And where we did some stuff on this interesting story, we actually made up a fraudster interview and recorded it on a phone. In fact, somebody in South America did it for me. She emailed it to me. We put it through the speech-to-text API, Watson API, and we had a text version. We fed this into the Watson personality profile API, and we did all that within an hour. And we had a view of what this person was like who was making this statement as part of a fraud interview. So it's that quick. And if you have the appreciation and the capability of accessing these things, you can try things very quickly. As I said, I think a lot of the area that this cognitive capability is actually being used is in contact centres. We've got two cases in the US. One is being used for auto sales, web sales, intervention of Watson, Q&A, suggestion, etc., interface, informed by a training exercise, and we've seen significant new business conversion rates. Interestingly, only when Watson is deployed in that transaction. So the client actually left it optional as to the user as to whether he did it or not. When he did it, much better conversion rates. When he didn't, less. So now the next step of the process, as part of this learning process, is to say, how can I actually invoke Watson capability or cognitive capability in the process in any case? Second example is around customer servicing. Lots of common questions, understanding the nature of the interaction with the customer, and therefore being able to answer and prompt call centre agents. Second case I've wanted to reference here was cognitive underwriting. I think cognitive underwriting is very similar to the claims exercise that we did, in the sense that there is a lot of unstructured data, key facts, I guess, if you like, in unstructured data, in broker submissions, etc., that never find their way into a formal rating engine or a rules engine, or even into a robotics engine. And so the ability to actually extract concepts and facts out of insurance technical documents, be they claims or underwriting documents, is another important part of the use of cognitive solutions. So this is quite quick. Internet of Things. There is an explosion of data that is around, that is coming from sensors. And the amount of money that will actually be spent on this is enormous. From my point of view, I've spent quite a lot of time on the connected home stuff, where we're really interested in, you know, there has to be a business case for this. This can't be a technology looking for a problem. But what it is looking at is to make sure that it is economically sensible to actually have these sorts of propositions. And what it's forced the thinking is to say, we can't be constrained by a standard home proposition. We need to actually be looking at other services where many people are interested in aged care, remote delivery of services, knowing when to respond and how to respond to a circumstance measured in a house. And so the propositions are actually are extending. I think I read today that you can improve your CLR by 20%. I think the Insurance Times said that with a smart home. The interesting thing is, who's going to share in that benefit? And so a lot of the modelling we've been doing is to say, I want to maintain my revenue. I can make a shed load of money by actually having a metered house. But now really what I want to do is actually extend my propositions to remote aged care or integrated home service repairs or whatever. So it's a different model. And certainly the IoT encourages more people to play in the ecosystem. You know, the ecosystem's nearly used as much as cognitive. But the fact is there are a lot of players who actually can be connected and deliver value to customers around exchange of information in a timely way. So if you actually look at the actuarial facts of this, there is risk assessment. The interesting thing is, how would you actually price insurance differently in the home? It's quite obvious from a telematics thing where, you know, there's clearly cost savings to be had by changed behaviour. I think it's less clear how behaviour will change in the way that somebody lives. But it may be pay as you live. There's clearly the association between the device capability in the home and the perils. So it actually puts quite a premium on peril-based rating, which most insurers use, I know. But how do you actually, how much can you actually influence an escape of water claim around a suitable meter appropriately placed with the appropriate technology and the appropriate learning alerting capability? But a lot of this is actually about looking at the customer in the round, offering them a broader based proposition, particularly remote aged care for parents with Alzheimer's or you know, some serious disease, where you can't be on the spot, but actually you know, by a rapid alert, you can actually invoke a service that you can buy as part of your household policy. Does also mean that you might end up with number of people in number of houses covered under the one policy. You may end up with policies that are much longer duration than 1 year. So there is a lot of product aspects to IoT. I mentioned these are the areas. I think telematics people will understand. Healthcare, I think there's something like about 14% of people in the US, adults in the US, use Fitbit or Apple Watch for health, etc. Lower outside of the US. Smart homes, about 7% of adults in the US have smart home technology, less in Europe. But there is no doubt that as the capabilities improve and the learnings improve, we will see these sorts of things. Predictive maintenance is an interesting one. My question is, will you ever buy white goods in the future? If you actually have white goods, meter-enabled, will you end up, and could be the insurer ends up, you know, becoming the agent for leased white goods? And the metrics around the use of white goods will drive maintenance programs, etc. And the same principles actually apply in the commercial area as well. So lots of different concepts to be considered around the data that will be available. The only comment I wanted to make here is that, you know, the sensors are quite cheap, maybe £10 or £15 per sensor. There's some standardisation of communication between devices and platforms, but the key answer to all of this is the platform. And we see in motor telematics there are a number of platform providers. A lot of the participants in that are actually receiving scores for driving patterns, but they don't actually get easily the full access to the data. So an important part of this platform capability is that you actually have the raw data, you analyse it the way that you want, and in fact you provide almost that you could provide a passport for your customers in terms of their living style or whatever, which may actually be a living style or a family style may become probably one of the more important rating factors. Steve mentioned about security, etc. If you actually look at this survey that I picked up recently from Forrester, I think it was this week actually, is hacking seems to be a major issue. Certainly external hackers and the ability to actually turn off the devices, which is really a function, I think, of the smartness. So there are lots of concerns to be dealt with here, but this gives a useful view of where people are concerned. And I suspect the millennials are less concerned about it than others. But an important part, particularly around the security legislation. And so a lot of the things really I've been covering here, I think, are, you know, the so what test. You know, is this really a technology looking for a problem? I think the behavioural change is important. You know, will people show inertia? How can you actually get early response to peril alerts? And we've been looking at whether you can have groups of people actually supporting each other, more a community type thing, where they are participants in the problem or in the opportunity. And therefore, does that actually mean something around how you might actually group people for insurance costs? Lots of different engagement models potentially there. Risk mitigation and pricing. The interesting thing is, does somebody's participation in this in fact say something about them? And therefore, all other bets, all other things aside, if you had no data that somebody was prepared to do this, does it become another rating factor? Our models have shown that you can have a win-win for insurer and customer around reduced cost of claims, improved services, and still make money for both sides under certain assumptions. The question is about also energy. Do you actually take that into account and actually provide the visibility to the customer around energy usage, which is about, I think, £1,100 a year for the average user? But more importantly, I think, is when you actually look at the round in an ecosystem, can you actually have white goods providers, you've got home emergency services, you've got the insurer, et cetera, is how can you actually get people to participate in an integrated ecosystem about a different proposition? Right. I've gone over. So I think we've covered quite a lot of things here in quite a short time. We've heard about different models, et cetera. NLP learning being a key part of it. The digital environment is a key part of this as well, in the sense that this is the way that people will want to integrate or interact with their providers, etc. Business ecosystems will bring together a number of players enabled by data, IoT, etc. But the other side to it is, in the end, these capabilities will be exploited by cognitive capability. And you can have all of these things here, but you'll get a suboptimal result if you don't actually have the cognitive capability to exploit that data, notwithstanding the constraints that data protection might have on it. And of course, the enabling infrastructure to have open access, the ability to use APIs, the ability to move data between applications is absolutely fundamental to delivering the proposition. So that's me done. Thank you for listening, and if you've got any questions, no doubt they'll come up in the session. And I think I've denied you 5 minutes of afternoon tea. Thanks.
The whole purpose of us being here, Graham, is to learn rather than have cups of tea. But that said, we've now got a 15-minute break for a cup of tea. I'd suggest we try and gather again at about 22:04, if that's all right, and get some fresh air.